So as we are approaching Passover season this year, as is typical of those of us in the church, we tend to turn our thoughts inward and do self-study, and that's an important part of this time of year. It's a good opportunity to reflect on how or if we've grown. That sometimes can be a little scary to kind of do an introspection during the year and say, now, how have I done? Every year when I was working for Nortel, I would sit down with my boss and I would get a progress report once a year. I was always scared of those too. I don't know why, but this is that time of year when you kind of turn to God as your commander in chief, and you get an assessment of how you've done, and you usually do that through self-study. I wanted to start in Ephesians chapter 5. Take me a little while to get to the topic for today, but I wanted to start a bit mysteriously here, and then I'll catch you up on where I'm going with this in just a moment. Ephesians chapter 5 gives us a list of things that we should make sure aren't in our lives at this time of year. It's a good list. We'll get to the list in just a moment, but I wanted to start out in verse 1 and 2. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1 and 2. It says, "Therefore, be imitators of God as dear children, and walk in love as Christ also has loved us, given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma." As we go into the Passover season this year, and especially if you look at the first two verses of Ephesians 5, there's two points there. One, Jesus Christ died for our sins. We know that that's a part of the Passover process. But it also says, as a result of him being willing to give himself for us, verse 1, therefore, we are to imitate him. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean we go get a hammer and nails and your wife nails you to a stake? No, obviously we don't sacrifice ourselves, but yet at the same time, we need to look into our lives in a self-study, figure out what was Jesus Christ like? How would he have handled this situation? And we often realize we fall short when we think about the how we handled the situation. And then, you know, you stop and think. Often things happen kind of suddenly. Something pops up and you respond to it. And then later on you think, boy, did I handle that right? And then you, as you look through it, you realize you probably could have handled it better. But verse 3 starts a list. I'd like for you to think about yourself as we go through this list. Do any of these things apply to you? Now, I would imagine for most of us in here, as we read through this list, we say, no, not me. Nope, check. Nope, I'm good there. Check. Let's just go through them. Verse 3, fornication. Hopefully nobody is involved with that. All uncleanness or covetousness. Let it not even be named among you as is fitting the saints. Neither filthiness, foolish talk, coarse jesting, for those things aren't fitting, but rather giving thanks. For this you know, no fornicator, no unclean person, no covetous man who is an idolater. I'd like for you to pay attention to that word because that's going to play into the whole rest of the sermon today and the sermon next time is idolatry. An idolater will have any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, don't partake in them. Okay, good list. So let's go through that list. Are you a fornicator? No. Do you lie? No. Do you use bad language? No. So sometimes we can go through lists like this and then come out and say, I'm good. And that's a good thing. I hope we can do that. But how do you become an idolater? How do you become an adulterer? How do you become someone that lies? What's the underlying cause that can be an instigator of getting into some of these things? I'm actually going to give you one example of that today. We'll get to that in just a moment. What I want to do is focus on idolatry in this list today, where it says in verse 5, an idolater will not have an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ. You, again, some would read this story and or this section of scripture and say, well, I'm not involved in any of those things. But I want to read actually two stories to you, one today and then the other one next week in part two of this. It'll be a two-part sermon about how someone who started out good allowed himself to have some underlying sin, and then from that underlying sin, he went into idolatry. And then see whether that underlying sin might be something that you and I might have to deal with too, especially as we come up on Passover this year. I'm going to be drinking a lot of water. I had a crown come off And I would usually put a cough drop in my mouth, but I can't do that right now. So I'll be drinking gallons of water while I'm up here. So anyway, what I want to do is I want to read a story. But before I get to that story, I want to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. Let's go to Psalm chapter 81. Psalm chapter 81, and I'll give you an example of an underlying sin that can lead to idolatry. And it's that underlying sin that we're going to talk about today. Psalm chapter 81, and I want to start in verse 8. In verse 8, you'll see at the start where it says, "Hear, O my people," I'd like for you to consider yourself there instead of just thinking of the psalmist David talking to ancient Israel. Put yourself in there and make this personal. Verse 8, "Hear, O my people," think of God talking to you directly, "and I will admonish you." Well, sometimes we don't like to be admonished. That sounds a little heavy-handed, but there are times when we need to be admonished. We need for someone to talk to us. "Hear, O Israel, if you'll listen to me." He almost sounds like he's just a little upset here, and I think you're going to see that he might be. Notice what he says in verse 9. "There shall be no foreign god among you, nor shall you worship any foreign god. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. Open your mouth wide, and I will fill it." Why would he have to say that? Do any of you have, I don't want to show of hands in case you do any of you have an idol in your home? I used to have one. Somebody bought me one that they had bought, and they thought it would be really neat for me to have it because I'd like to study ancient cultures and paganism and things. So they bought me one, thinking that would... So I didn't keep it around very long. I said thank you, and but as soon as they were gone, I threw it away because I don't want to have an idol in my house. So how many of you have ever been in a taxi cab where maybe there's something hanging from the rearview mirror or whatever, a little idol? Marlis and I have been listening to the Genesis tapes from Ralph Levy, and he mentioned people having household idols that they used to sit up on their mantle or something, and that was supposed to protect their house, etc. Well, I don't think any of us have those. So why would God tell his people to have no foreign gods among you? That doesn't seem like something that any of us... Surely there'd be some other things that would be more pressing, but God is warning his people to not have a foreign god. Verse 10, "For I am the Lord your God that brought you out of the land of Egypt." Dr. Avian's going to be giving some sermons here on Egypt and coming out of Egypt, etc. Here pretty soon, so you're going to be hearing about this, that God, the eternal God, was the one that brought Israel out of Egypt. So we shouldn't have another God. There's only one God, and he's the one that brought them out. But look at verse 11. "But my people would not heed my voice, and Israel would have none of me." Are we like that at times, where we get so wrapped up in things that we don't listen to what God has to say? But here's the crux of it, verse 12. "Because they wouldn't listen to God," notice what he said, "so I gave them over to their own stubborn heart to walk in their own counsel." You ever thought about that? How being stubborn can lead to many other sins. I want to talk today, and it's the title of this sermon, Stubbornness. How can stubbornness affect us? How? I just want you to think about this. I actually could have led with any of several sermons that talk about how stubbornness is a root cause of idolatry. Can you even put those two thoughts together? How could me being stubborn lead me to worship a foreign god? And yet we're going to read scripture after scripture after scripture that says exactly that. Stubbornness can be a root of allowing us to get into that whole list that I read earlier. Lying or coarse talk or idolatry or adultery or fornication or any of those things. Stubbornness is a root that can cause a lot of other problems in our lives. So God warns his people not to get into idolatry, but if we're not going to listen, then he says he just turns us over into our own stubbornness. How can that sin of stubbornness get into our lives and get us off track? I've got two stories. One, I'm going to give this week, and another one I'm going to give next week. So let's start with King Saul. We're going to talk about King Saul here. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 15. We're going to read all the way through 1 Samuel chapter 15. And we're going to see something very interesting about this poor fellow. He's one of those unfortunate ones, but he's one of those ones where he's going to come up in a resurrection and realize a whole bunch of stuff was written about him that's not too pleasant. He'll have some crow to eat, but it's a good lesson for all of us. So I want to look and see what it is that God said he was going to do. I would like for you, as I do often, put yourself in his shoe. God comes up to you and he says, by the way, I want you to be the king of the nation. What? You know, you're the one. I'm going to put you in this job. And you remember it said that when he started out that he was very humble and little in his own eyes and things were going well, etc. But something changed. We're going to read about what it is that changed in Saul's life and it caused him to fall into idolatry. Chapter 15 of 1 Samuel, verse 1. So here's Samuel. Prophet Samuel, he comes to talk to Saul. Samuel said to Saul, "The Eternal sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now, therefore, heed the voice of the words of the Eternal. Thus says the Eternal of hosts, I am going to punish Amalek for what he did to Israel." We'll read about that in just a minute. "How he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek." And now listen to what it is that God tells Saul to do. "Utterly destroy all that they have and don't spare them. Kill both man, woman, infant, nursing child, ox, sheep, camel, and donkey." I just could imagine if I'm Saul, I'm like, you want me to what? It almost sounds like genocide. You want to get rid of an entire race of people. Sounds rather harsh, doesn't it? Why would God tell Saul to do that? There's a reason, and we'll read about that in just a moment. You might even ask yourself, well, wouldn't a loving God want what's right for all people? And the answer is, yeah, absolutely. But maybe the right thing is to take somebody out of the way and bring them up later on in a resurrection. I want to read a similar thing. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 17 for just a moment. Exodus chapter 17 in verse 8. Nope, sorry, that's not what I want. Well, let's go ahead and start here anyway. This is about why God determined that Amalek was going to have to die. So let's go ahead and read this since we're here. Exodus chapter 17 and verse 8. It says, "Now Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose from among us men to go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.' So Joshua did as Moses said and fought with Amalek. And Moses and Aaron and Hur went up on the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when his hand came down, Amalek prevailed." You've heard this story. Dr. Avin might even talk about more of this in his sermon. This is one of the first battles that Israel got into, and it was against Amalek or against the Amalekites. "But Moses' hands," verse 12, "became heavy so that they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side, the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and the people with the edge of the sword." But notice that God does something very interesting. Now, they had lots of battles along the way, but this one is unique. Notice what he says in verse 14. "Then the Eternal said to Moses, 'Write this down in a book.'" You ever had a teacher do that? You know, he's droning along in some lecture, and all of a sudden he says, "Now, folks, you may want to write this down." What does that mean? There's going to be a test. And God knew there was going to be a test with the Amalekites. So he says, "Write this down in a memorial of a book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua," the one who won the battle. "I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." God promised way back here that he was going to wipe this nation out. Period. I know it sounds harsh, but this is what God said he was going to do. Let's go on and read. Verse 15, "Moses built an altar and called its name, 'The Eternal is my banner.' For he said, 'Because the Eternal has sworn, the Eternal will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.'" God knew that Amalek was going to be a thorn in the side of Israel from generation to generation. Why would God want to take away an entire nation of people? Because that nation of people was going to be a constant thorn in the side of the nation of Israel. I said this morning in Laurel. I tried to look this up and couldn't find it, but I remember hearing a sermon one time of a minister who said that in the Israeli army, as you're going out to battle, let's say you're going out to the field of battle and you're a football team and you huddle up and you say something that's like, okay, ready, break, right? They have this thing that everybody goes, yeah, and they charge out into the field. The Israeli army would get together, and just before they would go out after a meeting, they would say, remember the Amalekites. And the idea behind that was, there are times when God tells us to go fight, and we may not understand it, but if we are told to fight, we fight. Remember the Amalekites. So God was saying here, I want you to write it down in a book. The Amalekites are going to be destroyed. If not, they will burden you from generation to generation. Now again, why would God want to destroy an entire group of people? Go back to Genesis chapter 6, and let's look at an example, another time when God did that very thing. Genesis chapter 6, and I would just like to read verse 5. Genesis chapter 6, and verse 5. Then the Eternal saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Remember him saying that? That's right before he wiped out the entire planet, with the exception of 8 people. Why did he do that? Well, wouldn't God want to work with these people and call them or whatever? Yeah, he will. In the second resurrection, he'll bring them up with no Satan, and they will be called. But right now, every thought was only evil continually. And he knew that the best way for him to go forward with his plan was to wipe out everybody on earth except the family of Noah. Similar with Amalek. I want to read something to you that you may not realize. Let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 15. We'll start reading there in just a moment. I'm going to spend a little bit of time today and read from the commentary on the whole Bible from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. If you've never seen that, it's online. You can just go to google.com and type in Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, and it'll bring it up online. You don't have to pay hundreds of dollars for it. Under the article Amalek, I want to do some reading today. I'll do it in various parts throughout here. This is from Commentary of the Whole Bible by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Amalek was a powerful tribe which inhabited the country immediately to the east of the northern Cushites. Their territory extended over the whole of the eastern portion of the desert of Sinai to Rephidim, the earliest opponent of Israel. The hereditary and restless enemy of Israel. Listen to how he called it. Hereditary and restless enemy of Israel. That doesn't sound like someone that wants Israel to. It almost reminds me of some of the Shahs and others in Iran that have literally from the pulpit said, we want to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth. That's how these people thought. Let's go on and read. The restless enemy of Israel, who had not repented of their bitter and sleepless hatred during the 500 years that had elapsed since their doom was pronounced. We read that in Exodus 17. They were still bothering Israel 500 years after Exodus 17, when God said, we need to wipe this nation out, or they will plague you from generation to generation. And they were still doing it. Notice how it talks of them. Bitter and sleepless hatred. They hated Israel so much, they lost sleep over it. That is a people that needs to be taken out of the way. And so God said, I want them out. And here's what we're going to do. Being a people of nomadic habits, they were as a plundering and dangerous people, particularly to the southern tribes of Israel. The national interest of Israel required, and God as king of Israel decreed, that this public enemy should be removed from the earth. Their destruction was to be complete without reservation or exception. This was God's command, and that's what he told Saul. These people have been bothering you for 500 years. It is time to end the problem. So what does he say? Let's go back again to First Samuel chapter 15, where he says in verse 3, attack Amalek and destroy everything, man, woman, infant, nursing child, ox, sheep, camel, donkey. I want it all gone. Once and for all, I want this gone. And so that's the job that Saul is given. Now, does Saul remember what was written in Exodus, or was he just not paying attention? I think it's important for us to realize Saul knew exactly what his job was. He had the ability to know what was happening as well. We're going to read about that as we go. Let's look at Saul's rebellion here. Let's start in verse 4. So Saul gathered the people together, numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. He was ready to go to battle. And Saul came to the city of Amalek, probably their capital, and he laid wait in the valley. Verse 6, then Saul said to the Kenites, and this is kind of the key area here to know that Saul knew what he was doing. The Kenites were aligned with Amalek, and they were inside the city walls at the time. So Saul, from the outside, calls to the Kenites who are inside the city walls, and he says, depart from here, get down from among the Amalekites, because I'm going to destroy you with them, if you're still here. For you showed kindness to the children of Israel when they came out of Egypt. Dot, dot, dot. You obviously know that the Amalekites did not show kindness, but you did. So if you want to get out of here, you need to hightail it because this place is coming down. So the Kenites departed, wisely, from among the Amalekites. Verse 7, and Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. Now, remember what he was supposed to do? Men, women, children, infants, sheep, ox, donkey, camel. They're all to die. So here's what Saul does. Verse 8, and Saul took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. Was that a part of the process? No, that king wasn't supposed to be alive. And he utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. Verse 9, but Saul and the people, and we'll get to that in just a moment, Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen and the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good, parentheses, in their eyes, all that was good, and they were unwilling to utterly destroy them, dot, 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 like God told them to. But everything despised and worthless they utterly destroyed. It's interesting, isn't it? You can see the human reasoning. Well, God wouldn't want us to destroy all these. I mean, these are some good animals here. I mean, think about how they could help us. I mean, when times are getting tough and we'd have all this extra meat around and all that. And after all, it's the spoils of war, and everybody does that. So let's kind of save the best of the animals. Even though God said kill them, we know better than God. You're going to start seeing this come out. This idea, this kind of stubborn idea, we know better than God, so we're going to keep the best of the animals, but we're going to make God feel okay about it. You'll see that in just a minute. Verse 10. Now the word of the Eternal came to Samuel, so the prophet Samuel gets involved. Samuel's not here, by the way, watching this. Samuel's in another place. Verse 11. I greatly regret that I set up Saul as king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. I gave a very serious, here's what you do, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And Saul said, okay, well, I'll do 1, 3, and 7, but I'm not going to do 2, 4, and 6, right? This is the way God sees it. Notice Samuel's reply. I think Samuel really liked Saul. It says, it grieved Samuel, and he cried out to the Eternal all night. I think he was going before the throne of God and saying, no, please don't remove him. We can make this work. Let me work with him. I mean, whatever it was that Samuel was doing, he was honestly pleading on behalf of Saul. But verse 12, so when Samuel rose early in the morning and he went to meet Saul, notice something that was told him. And we're just going to see an attitude come out here. It was told Samuel saying, Saul went to Carmel and indeed he set up a monument to himself. Uh-oh. Is that what God said to do? After you wipe everybody out, I want you to set a pillar up to yourself so that everyone can honor you to be this great warrior. No, there's a real problem starting to develop, and it's going to get far worse as we go through this story. Saul went to Carmel set up a monument to himself, and now he's gone around and passed by and gone down to Gilgal. Where's Gilgal? Gilgal is where there was an altar to God. So the battle is over. He has in his mind that he wants to give a sacrifice to God for helping him win the battle. But what does he do first? He goes out of his way to Carmel and sets a statue up to his glory. Then he goes down to Gilgal to sacrifice to God. Wrong direction. Not only does God not tell him to make an offer to me of these sheep, he said, kill them all. But he never told him to do that offering, and he obviously never said, oh, and by the way, go set up a monument to yourself so people can honor you. That's just not how it works. So he set up a monument to himself. Going back to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, let me read some more here. It says, the erection of this vainglorious trophy was an additional act of disobedience. His pride had overborne his sense of duty in first raising this document to his honor and then going to Gilgal to offer sacrifice to God, neither of which God had asked for. By this willful and partial obedience to a positive command, complying with it in some parts and violating it in others, as suited his own taste, his own humor, Saul showed his selfish, arbitrary temper and his love of despotic power and his utter unfitness to perform the duties of that was delegated to the king of Israel. And like I say, it's going to get worse. This guy is going to go downhill and he's going to spiral real fast. And you're going to see how this leads ultimately to idolatry. Gilgal, again, was where Saul was going to give an offering to God. And again, I think in his mind, he thought this through and said, you know what? We could take some of these animals and offer them to God, keep the rest of them for ourselves. Surely this God would want us to do this. God just must not have thought this through. I mean, who knows what he was thinking about this all the way through. And there certainly were times when God did want them to make sacrifices, right? We read all through that. But not this time. Now, I'd like to ask the question, and I want to speculate here. I always do that, speculate, in big capital letters so that you all know that this is just me thinking. I thought through this. Why wouldn't God have wanted them to have made a sacrifice here after this battle? Again, this is just my speculation. What did these sheep represent, these sheep that he had? They represented the properties of the enemy of God. Would God want his property from his enemies to be sacrificed for him? When God wanted a sacrifice, what was the sacrifice to represent? It was always an unblemished firstborn, right? That kind of points you back to the Passover, to the fact that Jesus Christ eventually would come and die for the sins of the people. When God wanted a sacrifice, he wanted it to come from the people of God, right? He wanted it to be something that they had ownership of, something that they would have to give of their own substance. You know, I used the example this morning. Let's say that you want to give an offering to God, but you don't want to take any of your own money. So you go rob an ATM and then take that money from the ATM and say, I'm going to take that money and I'm going to give it to God. There's my tithe. No, God doesn't want money from an ATM that you stole. He wants money that you earned and tithed on. This needs to come from you, and the sacrifice needs to be an unblemished male lamb, etc., that's to represent the Passover. God did not want this sacrifice. And he's going to be very explicit here in just a moment. He's going to tell Saul, that's not what God asked you to do. Combine this error in judgment with the fact that he kept Agag alive. You ever wonder why he did that? The Romans used to do that. If they would capture a nation or whatever, they would take the king, and they would take the king back to Rome, and they would parade him down the streets of Rome in fetters to show that they were stronger than whatever king that they just did. The king of Babylon did that with the last king of Judah. Took him blind and in fetters and took him back and paraded him around the streets. Saul was supposed to kill them all. But Saul thought, well, I'll look even better if I have the king that I can parade around and say, see all this great thing that I did. For all I know, he may have had chiseled into that pillar that he stood up. Saul, the conqueror of Agag, king of the Amalekites. You never know. Let's go on. Verse 13. Then Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said, now again, I'm reading into this, it's almost like when you've done something wrong, think of it as a teenager, think back when you were as a teenager, or if your parents having teenagers, and you know you've done something wrong, you're coming home from school, and you walk in the front door, and you see mom or you see dad, and they say, hi, and before they can do any more, it wasn't my fault, and you just start talking, right? This is what Saul does. Look at the very first thing Saul says. Samuel comes to Saul, and Saul says, blessed are you of the Lord. Hi, mom. Hi, dad. You great people here. How are you today? I have performed the commandment of the Lord. Why would he even have to say that? You're going to see a problem here, and Saul is going to answer it here. Samuel is going to answer it here in just a moment. Whether Saul didn't get it or not, we're not told, but to me this reads more like he was trying to justify himself to Samuel. And we tend to do that as humans when we're wrong. We try and spin a mistake into a positive statement, often by blaming others. And we're going to see Samuel do that in just a moment, too. And my apologies, but I'm going to have to keep drinking water here if I'm going to get through this. Verse 14. So, again, Saul says, I have performed the commandment of the Lord. And kind of cheeky response here, Samuel says back, then what's the bleating of sheep in my ears? And the lowing of oxen that I hear. You performed this. Sorry, I'm hearing something that's making me think maybe this didn't happen quite like it was supposed to. I love that answer. I just think that's so. The shoe drops, and Samuel calls him on the carpet. He calls out Saul for his disobedience. But notice immediately the next thing that Saul does is he defends himself. Verse 15, then Saul said, No, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep. This isn't my fault. It's the people's fault. I told them they were supposed to kill everyone, but you know, there's a lot of them. There's only one of me. And so all of a sudden, all these sheep come along. That reminds me of something we'll get to in just a second. I just get a kick out of it when I read these. I have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen, to sacrifice to the Eternal, your God. You know, wasn't that a good thing? I know the people did this, but guess what? We're going to take and we're going to sacrifice to God. Isn't that a good thing? Wouldn't God be real pleased with that? And the rest we have utterly destroyed. There is a scripture that I want to turn to. Yeah, let's just do that now. I had it a little later in my notes, but let's go back to Exodus chapter 32. I want to read somebody else that did something very similar to this. When I read this, what Saul was doing, this reminded me of something that Aaron did. You probably know where I'm going, but I just got a kick out of this. When I put these two side by side, these guys could have been twin brothers. Here's Aaron here. This is the incident of the golden calf. So Aaron's done something wrong, just like Saul did something wrong. Samuel comes to talk to Saul. Moses comes down to talk to Aaron. And Aaron says to Moses, let not the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people. They're evil. That's exactly what Saul did. This isn't my fault. The people brought the sheep here. For they said to me, make us gods that will go before us. As for this Moses, we don't know what's happened to him. And I said to them, whoever has any gold, break it off and bring it to me. And they gave it to me, and I cast the gold into the fire, and out popped this calf. Right? I'm sure Moses could have said at the time, and what's that hammer in your hand used for fashioning gold or whatever? He probably was hiding it behind his back at the time. Just reminds me of Saul. This isn't my fault, it's the people's fault. And by the way, when I cast the gold into the fire, this calf just popped out. I mean, I've got no responsibility in this. All right, let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 15 again. Verse 16. Then Samuel said to Saul, and I love this, be quiet. You ever did that to your kids? They're trying to justify themselves for something. Stop talking. I want to think here for a minute, Samuel says. Be quiet. And I will tell you what the Eternal said to me last night. And Saul said, speak on. Now, everything that Samuel's going to say from here on out is not Samuel's words. It's God's words. And you're going to see Saul start to argue with the words of God. That is never a smart thing to do, arguing with God. That's exactly what he's going to do. Let's keep reading. Verse 17, so Samuel said, when you were little in your own eyes, were you not the head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Eternal appoint you to be king over Israel? Now the Eternal sent you on a mission, and he said, go and utterly destroy the sinners of the Amalekites. Fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Eternal? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Eternal? It's a very, very direct statement. Why didn't you do what God told you to do? Verse 20, you'll notice Samuel again, still very human and still not getting the point. Instead of saying, you know what, I blew it, he is still trying to defend himself. Verse 20, then Saul said to Samuel, but I did obey the voice of the Eternal. I went on the mission which the Lord sent me, and I brought back Agag, king of the Amalekites, but I utterly destroyed all the rest of them. I just brought this one guy back. Verse 21, but the people took the plunder, the sheep and the oxen, and the best that should have been destroyed. But they did it to sacrifice to your God in Gilgal. It's almost like trying to make Samuel feel bad for calling him on the carpet here. There's no responsibility of himself here. I find it interesting. This is, again, very, very human. It's what people do. To complement the story, he adds more to it. It was the people who took the sheep. I only took this one guy. But notice it was interesting what he left out. Oh, and by the way, I set a pillar up for myself. He didn't mention that, right? And several other things that he did. We'll kind of talk about those toward the ending. It doesn't matter. Saul opted to disobey God over his human reasoning. Again, from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Saul was either blinded by a partial and delusive self-love, or he was, in his declaration to Samuel, acting the part of the bold and artful hypocrite. I have a feeling it was the latter. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. I think that he said in his mind, if I just keep trying to talk positive about this, I'll eventually talk Samuel out of being mad at me. I have seen our teenagers do that. You probably have seen kids do that. You may have probably done it yourself. If I just keep talking long enough, maybe everyone will start to believe what I'm saying is right. And it's just not how it works, especially not arguing with God. God obviously knows what's going on. Again, from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. He professed to have filled the divine command and that the blame of any of the defects of the execution of the plan lay with the people. Notice Samuel's summation of Saul's problem. And this is where it gets to idolatry and stubbornness, because they're both mentioned here. Verse 22, so Samuel said, has the Eternal as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices or in obeying the voice of the Eternal? What's more important, that you do what God says or you in your own mind kind of outthink God? What could I do that will make God happy that also happens to be the exact opposite of what God told me to do? Which one is more important to him, obedience or sacrificing? And then not even waiting for Saul's reply, he just goes ahead and answers the question. Samuel says, behold, to obey is better than to sacrifice, and to heed God than the fat of rams. And then notice what he says in verse 23, because he kind of sums up Saul's problem here. Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. He was rebelling against God. It was just like he was the witch of Endor or whatever you want to say. It's just evil that this was happening. But then he also says something else. And stubbornness is as the iniquity of idolatry. Stubbornness leads to idolatry. We're going to talk more about that as we go on today and on into next week. How does stubbornness equal the iniquity of idolatry? Because you rejected the word of the Eternal, and you have also he has also rejected you from being king. Stubborn as the sin of idolatry. Who was, and this is a question I'd actually like to have an answer of if you're bold enough to answer it. Who was Saul idolizing? Himself. He was self-deceived into self-idolizing. I won the battle. I need a pillar set up for me. I need to take Agag. I keep calling him Agog. I don't know why I do that. Agag. And I need to parade him around the streets in fetters. I need to go up to Gilgal to sacrifice to God. And you're going to see here in a minute why he wants to do this. It's not because he wants to sacrifice to God. There's an ulterior motive here. His stubbornness at not obeying God led him into self-idolatry. I'm the greatest. Remember Muhammad Ali used to say that? I'm the greatest. You know, no one can defeat me. I am the pinnacle of the human male. I mean, he was excited about his own virility, and he was trying to express that. His stubbornness to not follow God led him to being puffed up with pride on his accomplishments. Now, when I say puffed up with pride, that should remind you of something. We talk about that during Passover, and we talk about that during unleavened bread. We should not be puffed up with self-pride. But you can sometimes get so stubborn, and that's true of everybody in this room. You may not think you're an idolater, and I don't think I'm an idolater, but I can be so stuck on something, and I'll give you some examples in just a minute, so stuck on something that even though there's a clear command from God to do something else, I want my way. So when we sit down every year and we go through the Passover and we think about what it is that we, how we've done this past year, and I say this every year and I mean it sincerely, I go before God before Passover and I'm somewhat embarrassed at the fact that I tell him right after Passover, during unleavened bread, here's the things I'm going to work on this year. And then I get around to Passover and it's like, oh boy, some of that stuff is still there because I just stubbornly don't want to get rid of it. It's fun. We'll talk about some of those in just a minute. Again, from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Samuel saw the real state of the case, and in discharge of the commission that he received before setting out, he proceeded to announce his conduct as characterized by pride, rebellion, and obstinate disobedience. This all comes from this stubborn attitude that he had. When Saul persisted in declaring that he had obeyed, alleging that the animals were the problem of the people, etc., all these lies that he did, it was an attempt to conceal the selfishness of the original motive under the cloak of religious zeal. I want to read that again because that's the crux of what was happening in Saul's life. In his attempt to conceal his selfish personal desire, he did all of these things that he did under the cloak of religious zeal. We can do that as people. Let's talk about what stubbornness looks like to all of us today. Any time that I have ever done any marital counseling, and I'll bet you Doc Avent could say the same thing, almost to a person, the problem between the two people is neither one of them wants to be the one that's wrong. I can't tell you how many times I've had someone call me and say, we're having some problems and I would like for you to come and counsel us. And I say, okay, well, what kind of things do we need to be counseled? You need to tell her that she's wrong. And that's what happens. They don't want you to tell them that they're wrong. They want you to tell them the other person is wrong. I have never had a counseling yet, and I would just love it if I would sit down and I would say, okay, so what's going on? And for both of them to say, we're just not nice to our spouses like we should be, and we want you to help us to learn how to be nice to each other. That's just not what happens. By the time the minister gets involved, it's finger-pointing. You need to tell that person that they need to obey me. Well, you need to tell him that he needs to pick his shoes up. Well, you need to tell him. And it's stubbornness. You don't want to get rid of your beliefs. You want everybody else to become like you. And that's similar to what was happening with Saul. The crux of almost every major marital flare-up is stubbornness. Wives, don't elbow your husbands right now, okay? Just keep your elbows to yourself. It's also the crux, and I've said this before too, there are a lot of people that write indignant papers to the church about the Hebrew calendar or the new moons or something like this. And they have studied, and they have direct influence from God. And it doesn't matter, Church of God or Worldwide Association, if you've got PhDs that are studying this, you need to listen to me. That's arrogance that comes out. They stubbornly want their way to be right. And I get those at least once a month. I get letters from people that write into PCD, like you saw him talking about, that chastise us for some doctrine, and it's usually over the Hebrew calendar, the using of the word Yahweh, or the new moons. That's one; those three things just come up at least once a month. And the letters drip with stubbornness and self-righteousness. And to me, that's just what Saul was going through. That's what stubbornness looks like today. Verse 24, let's keep going. Unfortunately, it gets worse. Verse 24, then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. Oh, now it's, okay, that sounds pretty good, right? You think of when Nathan came to David, after David sinned with murdering Uriah and with Bathsheba, you think, okay, so David said to Nathan, I've sinned. And then Nathan says what? Your sins are forgiven you. But let's go a little further and see what it is that he's saying here. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Eternal and your words. Yeah, I know I didn't follow the commandments of God, but Samuel, I've obviously upset you. And that's the whole direction of this conversation is going to go, not going to go toward God, it's going to go toward Samuel. Because I feared the people and I obeyed their voice. Look at verse 25. Now therefore, and he's talking to Samuel, please pardon my sin. He's asking Samuel to forgive him. Who should he be asking to forgive him? He should be going to God, like David did. Read Psalm 51. David wasn't apologizing to Nathan. David got on his knees and apologized to God. Verse 25, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Eternal. Have you ever had this happen? Maybe a kid goes to mom and says, Mom, I've blown it. I've done something really wrong. And dad's going to be home and he's going to be furious. So I'm apologizing to you. And I want you to come with me to dad and you help explain it because I certainly can't face dad alone. That's almost what he's doing. I want to go sacrifice to God, but I need you to come with me. You talk to God. You and God are tight. You can help me through this. He's not apologizing to God. He's wanting Samuel to go intervene on his behalf. And it gets worse. This isn't the end of it. Unfortunately, it just goes downhill from here. So Samuel wisely, verse 26, says to Saul, I will not return with you. You have rejected the word of the Eternal, and the Eternal has rejected you from being king. I'm not going to go to God for you on this. You had a job to do and you didn't do it. Samuel, by this time, really sees what's happened. I'm sure Samuel can see the hypocrisy in Saul. And he's like, no, sorry. I really liked you. I prayed all night for you, but I can see something now, and I'm not taking this to God. You have been rejected. Verse 27, what should he have done at this point? Should have fallen on his knees and asked God to forgive him, but it gets worse. Then Samuel turned around to go away, and Saul seized the edge of his robe and tore it. So Samuel said to him, the Eternal has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. And also the strength of Israel will not lie or relent, for God is not a man that he should relent. Then he said, verse 30, I have sinned. Okay, now it sounds like we're heading in the right direction, but then notice the very next thing he says. I have sinned. Yet honor me now. He wants Samuel to honor him. It's incredible when you think about what it is that Saul is doing here. I have sinned, yet honor me now, please, before the elders of my people and before Israel. I know I've sinned against God. I know God's going to think bad of me, but I want to look good before the people. So go with me down to this sacrifice so that I can stand up and I can sacrifice all these animals and I can say this great prayer to God and I can look like a hero to the people. He isn't concerned about the fact that God is upset with him. He's concerned about looking good in front of the people. That's what his stubbornness, that's what his selfishness, that's what this self-idolizing. I am the great king, and I need for people to realize that I am the great king. So his final request of Samuel, honor me before the people. Make me look good. See how stubborn a nature had led Saul into sin. I actually want to give several examples of things that Saul did wrong here, and then we'll talk a little bit about them. Saul chose the act of sacrificing over obedience to God. He listened to the people. Have you ever had trouble with that with your peer group? Maybe you're at school and the kids want to go do something and you have to figure out whether or not you're going to do it. I actually came up with a couple of examples of things that happened to me when I was working at Nortel. I'll talk about a couple of those. How often do you have to make a decision of whether you're going to obey God or you're going to succumb to peer pressure? Here's a couple of examples. We're going to have a team building exercise. Well, that sounds good, right? You're at work. You've got your crew of 15 or 20 people. We're going to have a team building exercise. So we need for everyone to come with us after work today, or maybe it's on Saturday, or maybe, you know, whatever. And we're going to have a team building exercise. Okay, I'm in. What are we going to do? We're going to go down to the local bar, and we're going to have Jell-O shots. Okay, now this doesn't sound like team building, but what do you do? Now you got to start making a decision. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, we're going to get together, and after a couple of drinks, you know, you're going to loosen up, and we're going to talk, and we're all going to get to know each other, and that's team building. Well, I don't want to do that. Well, you know, just have a couple, and then you go home. Oh, okay, and then you go. And then a couple leads to four, leads to five, and now all of a sudden it's gone past team building, and it's gone in to sin. Peer pressure has driven you. What was Saul like when the people, you know, you'd imagine all these people going, I'm not killing that sheep. You want to kill these thousands of sheep? You go kill them. I'm not doing it. And Saul's, now he's starting to succumb to peer pressure. It's just not a good thing, but that's what happens. Peer pressure sometimes gets to him, just like it did Saul. Here's something else he did. He praised himself first rather than God for the victory. God said 500 years before Samuel, I'm going to, at some point in time, wipe these Amalekites out. And God says, Saul, I want you to do this. If you do this, I'm going to be with you. You're going to get rid of the enemy of God once and for all. You would have thought the first thing out of Saul's mouth was, the enemy of God has finally been defeated. Let's go. If nothing else, let's go to Gilgal and thank him. I could see that. But no, that's not what he did. He praised himself first rather than God. Another thing he did is he argued with Samuel. Now remember, Samuel was telling him what God said, so in essence, he was arguing with God. That is never a good idea, to argue with God, but he felt like he should do that. He preferred the glory of the people over the rebuke of God. He just wanted to look good in the eyes of people. I've even seen people do that before. It's like, well, I don't want to look bad in front of my friends, so I'll go ahead and I'll do something that I shouldn't do. I'll sin. And then afterwards, when I'm home, then I'll ask God for his forgiveness. But I just can't look bad in front of my buddies, right? So you get into the coarse talk, or you do things that you shouldn't do, the locker room humor, whatever. And then you go later to God and say, you know, I shouldn't have done that, and I'm sorry, I just don't want to look bad in front of my friends. That's salt. You don't want to be like that. Especially as we come up to Passover this year and we start thinking about what it is that we need to be getting rid of in our life. Again, if you want to take the time to do this, we won't do it today, but go through Psalm 51 and read what David's prayer was to God after his sin. You're going to see a very different personality than that of Saul. What I want to do with the rest of the time today, and let's see how my time is doing. Okay. What I want to do with the rest of the time today is go through a few scriptures that talk about stubbornness and how serious God takes this. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 21. We'll finish today off with five or six scriptures that talk about stubbornness. Deuteronomy 21 and verse 18. Deuteronomy 21 verse 18. This is the law of God on how to handle stubbornness. Verse 18. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son. Now, it does say son here, and it is in the male. I would say that this basically means if you have a child. But somehow stubbornness seems to run in boys more than girls. I'm not sure why that is. And in men rather than women. Sometimes guys can get really stubborn. But anyway, it says here, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, who when they have chastened him, he will not heed them, then his father and his mother will take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of the city, to the gate of the city. And they will say to the elders of the city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. You see where being stubborn leads to? It can lead to idolatry. We saw that earlier. It can lead to being drunken and stubborn. I like the taste of alcohol. I like to be rebellious. I like to chase women. I like to do things that I shouldn't do. This stubbornness causes this boy, in this case, to tell his parents, I'm not going to obey you. I would rather be stubborn than obey you. What does God say about that? Verse 21, then all the men of the city will stone him to death with stones. Teenagers, aren't you glad you didn't live back then? You wouldn't have been as stubborn back then as teenagers are today. You know, there were no safe spaces for you to go to back in those days. If you were stubborn and you wouldn't listen to your parents, they would take you to the city gates and you would die at the hands not only of your parents but of the elders of the city. But notice what it says about this. I think this is interesting. Then all the men of the city will stone him to death with stones so that you will put away the evil from among you. We're not talking again necessarily about idolatry or adultery or murder or anything like that. We're talking about being stubborn. Why? Because it is a gateway. It is a cause that leads to so many other sins in your life. So again, think of that very first scripture that I went through, which talked about all this list of all these things that we should be avoiding. What are the underlying things that can lead you to become rebellious against God, being stubborn against God? God was so insistent that he wanted stubbornness and rebellion taken away because it was an evil that needed to be taken away from the people. Where, if you stay stubborn, where does it ultimately lead you? Let's turn to Judges chapter 2. This is a very simple statement. It's a single verse, Judges 2, verse 19. This talks about what happens if a person, let's use it today, a person in the church maintains his right to his stubbornness. Now, to give you the background of what this is like, and you remember this, ancient Israel would sin. God would cause some plague or something to come on them. They would cry out to God. He would send a judge to straighten them out. As long as the judge lived, they were doing pretty good. But then the judge would die, and they would start to sin, and then God would cause a calamity, and they would cry out to God, and he would send a judge, and it would just go on and on and on. This is one of those. Verse 19, it came to pass, when the judge was dead, that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than even their fathers by following other gods. Now we're back into idolatry, but notice that what stems from it. By following other gods to serve them and to bow down to them. And they did not cease from their own doings, nor turn from their stubbornness. They just did not want to get rid of that fun from the past. Right? So the judge would come along and say, we got to put all these idols out. We got to tear down these groves and all of that. And so they would do that. But in the back of their mind, boy, I miss that. Right? I mean, I didn't grow up in this area, so maybe I'm talking out of school here, but have any of you ever said or thought, you know, I miss the days when we used to have the crawfish boils down at the local VFW hall or something like that. Oh, I just miss the taste of crawfish. I miss the taste of pork. I mean, I grew up in the church, so I didn't have, I don't know what pork tastes like, except if I get it by accident, I get sick. But I don't have... But maybe you do. Maybe you grew up where you had crawfish once a week or whatever, and there's something back there that every time I go into a restaurant and I smell that smell, it just reminds me of the good times. That's what these people were doing. They weren't getting rid of the bad. They were kind of thinking, I remember those, right? And we're going to read an example about that in just a minute. When someone shows you the right way, if you're not led by the Spirit of God, you can often revert to it. We stubbornly tend to hold on to our past. Let's go to Numbers chapter 11. I want to read an example of this. Numbers chapter 11. Sometimes we can revert to our old ways and not think about what we're saying. And I want to give you an example of that. This is something that ancient Israel did, which I find hard to believe, and yet I would just have to imagine if I were there, I may have done the same thing. Who knows? Verse 4. Now the mixed multitude who were among them, this is Israel coming out of Egypt. Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? They were being fed manna and they were being given water, but they weren't being given meat and they were missing it. Verse 5, we remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt. Sorry. I don't remember anything about eating fish freely in Egypt. I remember slavery, and having to make, you know, get your own straw to make your own bricks and taskmasters. It's like they're forgetting about all of the trouble that came with this. They remember having fish. It's almost like the slavery was no big deal. They'd like to go back to that as long as they could eat fish again. I don't think they really meant that, but that's what they're saying. And we remember the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onion and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up and there's nothing but this miracle from God. We would rather go back to slavery than have a miracle from God. How could they even come to that point? But there was something in their mind that wanted to go back to the old ways. I hate to even think of any of us being like that or of me being like that, but stubbornness can do that. I want something and I don't have it and I'm going to throw a fit until I get it. And that's exactly what you see here. You know, we teach our children to not do that. And let's turn to Psalm chapter 78. There's another example of this. Psalm chapter 78. We've only got two scriptures left. Psalm 78. I got a kick out of this one as I was reading through this. It reminded me of something. Psalm chapter 78 in verse 6. I want you to think about being a parent and having children. Now, you may not be a parent yet. We've got some teenagers here. We've got some young adults that aren't married, don't have kids. But I'd like for you to think about this as a parent trying to teach a child. And you've done things in your past that hurt you, and you don't want your kids to have to go through the same thing. So let's read through this. Verse 6, that the generation to come, your children, your grandchildren, might know them, the laws of God, the children who will be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children. Parents and grandparents naturally want to teach their children and grandchildren the right way of life. That's just a normal thing. Verse 7, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. All of us, as parents and grandparents, want our kids and grandkids to stay focused on the truth of God. Why? Verse 8, so that they won't be like their fathers. Right? I don't know how many of you went through things in your life where you realized, boy, I don't ever want my kids to do that. And so you double down and you get maybe a little heavy-handed with them because you know how that hurt you and you don't want them to have that hurt. But it's interesting because what you see is your kids might look at you and say, they're trying to keep me from having the same fun they had. And the parents are saying, I'm trying to keep you from the hell that I went through. And then there's this butting of heads here, and then the kid gets stubborn and the parent gets stubborn. I tell you a story. Again, this is from someone that I used to work with. He was married, and there was another lady that was in the office with us, and she was married. And she had a kid. She had a son who was a teenager. So this man and this woman started to have an affair with each other, and it caused both marriages to end in divorce. So they get married, and now this guy has a stepson, and he was trying to tell his stepson having sex outside of marriage is wrong and you shouldn't do it. What did he do? He had an affair. So what's the teenager going to do? The teenager's going to look at you and say, you're a hypocrite. And the parent's going to say, no, I'm telling you, this did not work out well because they ended up getting a divorce too. In fact, I think both of them married four or five times. They just never learned the lesson, but they wanted their kid to not suffer from that. We teach our children strict adherence to God's law so they won't end up making the wrong choices that perhaps we did. They both get dug in, they both get stubborn. And if we are not careful, that stubbornness can lead to something very disastrous. Let's turn forward to Psalm chapter 81, and we'll end with this. This will be the last scripture for today. Psalm chapter 81, verse 11 and 12. If we get to the place, remember Saul, he just would not give up on his stubbornness, and finally God removed him. That can happen to us as the people of God too. Look at what it says in Psalm chapter 81, verse 11 and 12. But my people would not heed my voice, and Israel would have none of me. So what does God say that he's going to do? So I gave them over to their own stubborn heart and to walk in their own counsels. If you maintain stubbornness, if I maintain stubbornness, at some point in time, God's going to withdraw his spirit. and say, you want to maintain that stubbornness? I'm out of here. And you won't be a part of God's way of life anymore. Nobody wants that. Verse 13, oh, that my people would listen to me. That's what your father wants of you as a young person in his church. He has seen the results of Satan's way, and he does not want you to have that. So what is he asking of you? Get rid of that stubborn streak that just wants to go back to sin, that looks so alluring. You know, you see, watch television and you see people drinking or partying or doing things, and it looks like so much fun. There is nothing fun about waking up the next day with a hangover. But yet it looks fun at the time, and it's horrible later. Oh, that my people would heed my voice, but Israel would have none of me. So I gave them over to their own stubborn heart to walk in their own counsels. If not corrected, stubbornness can not only separate us from our physical parents, but they can separate us from God. Stubbornness is something that we have to make sure that we eradicate from our lives. And as we think about Passover coming up, we need to be asking ourselves, is there something in my life, is there a stubbornness about me that is keeping me from making real progress toward becoming like and the imitating of Jesus Christ? Next time that I'm here, which will be 2 weeks from now, I want to review another story of a very stubborn man in the Bible and see where it landed him. And then I also want to look at several metaphors that the Bible uses for stubbornness. Terms like stiff-necked or haughty. Those are also metaphors for stubbornness. Why does the Bible use the term stiff-necked? What does that mean? Where did that come from? We'll talk about that. And then finally, how we can recognize it in ourselves and how we can work to remove it as we prepare for this year's Passover.